Okay, let's get going. So, what did we do last lecture? Well, we finally took the full set of Maxwell's equations. Then we set rho equals j equals zero so that we were in a source-free medium, away from any sources that may generate electromagnetic waves. But still, I imagine there exists outside the volume of interest for me some source of electromagnetic radiation that is going to maintain solution, non-zero solutions of Maxwell's equation with no source terms. Okay? That creation stuff taking place somewhere else is a radiation problem that we'll study more. But I'll say a few things about that in today's lecture. Okay, more of interest for us is how these waves are explained or described by Maxwell's equation as they propagate through this medium where there are no sources for generating new electromagnetic waves, except for the time varying E and B enhancing one another and making the field propagate. Okay, so, and we already reached some conclusions. There is a propagation direction, and there are E fields and H fields that are always pointing perpendicular to the propagation direction, and a certain relationship between their magnitudes. Okay, so these are, let me remind all this within the context of some example. Let's do an example. So I consider a function of time, f of t, and this is going to be the function that by which we will express E and H, okay? And I take f of t to be the rectangle function of t over tau, and let's say tau is 1 microsecond, 10 to the minus 6 seconds, and that corresponds to a corresponding distance of 300 meters if you convert time into distance using c, the speed of light, 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, or 300 meters per microsecond. That's how you can write it, okay? And here's a reminder of what this function looks like. It is 0 at minus tau over 2, 0 at tau over 2. In between it is unity, so this is full length tau. And this is my time axis. That's my f of t. All right, so using this f of t, I can sort of like put down a certain propagating electromagnetic wave that will satisfy Maxwell's equation in source-free medium. Let me propose one such thing, okay? I will say that my h is a function of time and space, and it points in a direction, unit direction y, and it is this function, f of t, except that it's not just f of t. It is f of t minus z over c. If I say h is y times f of t, where f of t is this function, and plug it into Maxwell's equations, I'm going to see nonsense. It is not going to satisfy Maxwell's equation. But as soon as I place this equation where t and z are combined in this fashion, this is going to be a valid solution. All right? It will satisfy these Maxwell's equations without any sources in them. Moreover, there is going to be an accompanying E, okay? Well, let's set our coordinate system so we know what we are talking about. This is a right-handed coordinate system, x cross y points in z direction, and I just claim that there is a magnetic field wave. Wave because it depends on time and space, okay? And it is pointing in unit vector y direction. And I have z here, and because of that z, I know that propagation is taking place in z direction, plus or minus z direction, but with the minus sign, I already know that that propagation is going to be in plus z direction. And then there is an accompanying e, and that accompanying e is going to be 90 degrees away from this, and I can get to it by multiplying the h by some number. What is that number? The very last number that we talked about in yesterday's or Friday's lecture. Eta, exactly. If I started with B, I would multiply B with what number? C, okay? But if you are working with H, then you multiply it by eta, you turn it into an E. Had I started with an E, I would have gotten H by taking E and dividing it by eta. Or I would have gotten B by dividing it by C. All right, so, and then, of course, it's going to be in a different direction. Which direction? Use your right hand. If I align my right fingers along x and do x cross y, that points in plus z direction, my thumb. And indeed, that electric field is going to be in this direction. This is going to be E, this is going to be H, and so I continue here. I need to select unit vector direction x, then I multiply this thing by eta naught, and eta naught is square root of mu naught over epsilon naught. And when you put the numerical values of these things in MPS systems, you get this to be 125 volts. You put an approximation here because you use for epsilon an approximation of 1 over 36 pi times 10 to the 9. So it's 120 pi, approximately, very good approximation. If you multiply that, what does it work out to be? Anybody remembers from some other course? 8 and 9, some, do you remember? Any other value? Anybody?
377.
Okay, somebody has a calculator. All right. 377, more or less something like that. Just use 120 pi, because chances are in your calculation there's going to be some other pi and you can cancel that things work out. Okay, don't use the other one. All right, so any questions? So let me finish this. And f of t minus v over c. So now I have the fields worked out. And these will satisfy Maxwell's equations. Okay, of course I could have had something like t minus x over c as long as this wasn't point, well, that could even point in y direction, okay? What about t minus y over c pointing in y direction? That would imply that the propagation is y direction, but the field is also pointing in x direction, in the same direction. That's a no-no, okay? That's a no-no because we came in our derivation of this, okay? We came and saw that divergence of the electric field have to be zero, okay? And if F was pointing, it was varying in Z direction, and also pointing in Z direction at the same time, its divergence would not be equal to zero, and that would be wrong, okay? As long as the propagation direction and the direction in which H and E are perpendicular to one another, then potentially it's a good solution. But once you have either E or H satisfying this, the other one has to be also selected to be perpendicular to mutually all the other vectors. So that's about it. Any questions here? All right, so pictorially then, this is our function shown as a function of time. Z is not in this picture. But we can now picture these guys in terms of Z and T. We can make different plots. We can go to a certain location and make plots as a function of time, or we can take snapshot pictures of how this waveform looks as a function of position at given times. Okay, so let's just try that one. Let's look at H sub Y. Let's plot H sub Y, because homework wants you to do this sort of thing, so I might as well give a few examples. It helps in visualizing these things. H sub Y as a function of Z, okay? And if I look at t equals 0 snapshot, I have to take the f function and evaluate as minus z over c. Okay, well, that's a rectangle function. It's going to be now centered around z equal to 0. And it's going to have a certain extension. And the question is, what is this length going to be and what is this position going to be? Jason? So basically, originally, this rectangle function is always going to have its transition whenever its argument is equal to plus and minus 1/2, okay? In this case, with t equals 0, and then there is an implied tau. I can replace this guy to be more specific. Rectangle function divided by tau, right? We had something like this here. Now, at t equals 0, I set this equal to plus and minus 1/2, and what's gonna that's gonna I can take my tau and c to the other side, and I have my transition at c tau divided by 2 plus and minus. Is that correct? What is c tau divided by 2? Tau is 1 microsecond. It's 300 divided by 2 plus and minus 150 meters. So then at t equals 0, this is 150 meters minus plus 150 meters. And this is the extent of this picture. This is a snapshot, t equals 0 snapshot.
Yeah.
Any questions? Now what about, let's now go to 5 microseconds. What's going to happen? Well, that's easy to figure out. According to this equation, now I'm going to find the center of that rectangle, not at z equals 0, but at z equals, setting t minus dt equal to 0 and solving it for z. I'm going to find it at t times c, 5 microseconds times c. That's going to give me how many meters or how many kilometers? 5 times 3, which is 1,500 meters or 1.5 kilometers. So So on this scale, I'm going to have my rectangle moved up to somewhere here. So this is 1,500 meters. And the width of this whole thing is still 300 meters long. Okay? So that's how this thing works. Any questions? So what about t equals minus 5 microseconds? Where is the pulse? On the other side, okay? It used to be here. This is t equals 5 microseconds. And this is where it was. Again, this is 1,500 meters. T equals minus 5 microseconds. So this wave is going in this direction, in the positive z direction, and it's a positive z propagating field. Any questions? You? You're good. Okay, so and the shape doesn't matter. Let's define a new function, r of t. I define r of t to be a ramp, okay? You go from 0 to maximum 1, okay? So I have r of t tau, if you wish, 1 microsecond ramp, centered around t equals 0, okay? So then, what will these pictures look like? Let's go back to t equals 0. What do I put here? Let's see. Why don't you help me?
A ramp.
Ramp, but be careful. Just a ramp or something weird happens to it? So basically, this guy here becomes ramp function rather than rectangle function. At t equals 0, I have r of minus z c tau in the bottom. So if I were to plot that, do I get a ramp as a function of c, or what else do I get? I get a flip ramp. You see the flip, right? You remember from ECE 210, when you are doing convolutions, you have to flip things around before multiplying and all that. So it's just like that. There is a minus sign and it gives a ramp, but a flip ramp. Okay? And what about at different times? At different times you get this thing. This became this, then became this. So where is the source of this field? Where is it coming from? Elmo, where is it coming from? It's coming from somewhere. Okay, so I am asking Elmo at this point, because after yesterday's lecture or Friday's, Elmo said, hey, I can see some of this math, but I'm confused about all physics. That's what you said, right? He wants more intuition. And I told him that intuitions are going to come when you see what we are doing here and link it to other things that you know. Okay? First of all, there is some physics, some math that accompanies that physics. And if that math is coming out and saying that this function describes a rectangle or a ramp that used to be here, then here, right, Elmo, you start saying, hey, this may be reasonably called propagation. Correct or not correct?
Correct.
But correct in the following sense. You then, when you make that sentence, you make links between what you are saying there and your other experiences earlier in life. What are the relevant experiences in life to interpret this as a propagating wave? Well, it may be different for different people, but most of us will agree that we see a wave when a pebble is taken and thrown into a pond. When a pebble falls into a pond, what happens? We have concentric circles that propagate the wave. That is the word that we use in English. I don't know what you use in Chinese. What do you use? Something that everybody will understand probably in this class. Or majority, let's say. What is propagation in Chinese? Huh? Fase? Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is in Turkish. I've been doing this so much in English that I don't know scientific terminology in Turkish anymore. All right. So that's propagation, okay? Another wave, Elmo, is waves. So this f of t could have been a cosinusoid. And we talked about that last lecture. And it doesn't matter. Then you have cosinusoid waves moving on. Cosinusoid waves, of course, repeated peaks. All those peaks are moving. And you see this all the time when you're in the beach, right? In the beach, you see waves coming. That's propagation. Now, in a more general sense, a propagation refers to time and space varying variations. It could be electric fields. It could be sound waves. It could be anything like that, where there is a readjustment in space-time of a certain quantity that typically carries some amount of energy. You know that sound waves carry energy, because my cords are generating something that you are hearing. When you hear that, that's because your eardrums are trembling in sympathy and with some delay with respect to my cords. Okay, so I am putting some energy, and that energy gets there and does something there. Likewise, these guys also carry energy. So propagation is time-varying response that you see in systems where energy is carried from one point to another point spatially, something like that. Any questions? Now, it's all math at some level, but at some other level, it's all things that we have seen and observed. So we are putting our experiences and math together. This is what's done in science. Now, I will give one more picture to help out with those who are sharing the same difficulty. By the way, how many of you are confused about what a propagation is, what a wave is, and so forth? Anybody else sharing? I'm sure some of you do, but yet I know that you will not raise your hand. Because it is an abstract concept. After all, we see with electromagnetic waves, but we don't see electromagnetic waves. Or maybe it's like fish in the water type of a situation, right? When we see things, our eyes are responding to all electromagnetic waves that are imaging whatever is in front of our eyes. But yet at the same time, it's not something tangible like this chalk, and therefore it leaves to imagination. It's an abstract concept in some sense. Now, Faraday had a beautiful way of thinking about this way before Maxwell, okay? And eventually it was Maxwell who put the equations contributing the displacement current term so that wave solutions can come out from Maxwell's equations. But Faraday sort of like foresaw this. The way he foresaw this is this. He thought about a dipole. He says, suppose I have a dipole, okay? A plus charge separated from some minus charge by some distance d. This has a dipole moment. Whatever the charge here, q times d, is dipole moment. And this has an electric field structure. He was very well aware of that. He didn't know how to mathematically see it, but he could see it through his lines of force. He says, there is a field line going from plus to minus, and then there are more of those, and there are even more of those. He came up with this familiar picture of a dipole. He says that it doesn't matter how far away from this dipole, I am always under the influence of these lines of force. You know, if I go real far away, the lines of force passing through me are weak, but there they are, okay, all the way to infinity. Then he says, what if, okay, after having a dipole like this sitting forever, I start changing this distance d. Let me reduce this d. What's going to happen? Well, the entire field out there is also going to weaken. But he asked himself the question, is it going to weaken everywhere instantaneously as soon as I start changing my d? He says, no, it can't be. It's just too weird. It can't be the case, he said. He says, suddenly, suppose I take my d and reduce to zero. I take my minus and put it on top of plus. What happens to the dipole field structure? It should collapse. It should go away. If you wait long enough, there's going to be zero electric field all places. But is this zero electric going to be established right away at all places, infinitely far? He says, no, no way. That's not how life works. Therefore, he says that whatever I'm doing must be propagating at some finite speed. The fact that I have now collapsed my dipole into nothingness is a new information that has to go to further away places. It's not going to happen to go, it's not going to go instantaneously. So there must be a speed associated with it. But he did not know how to calculate that speed. Although the speed of light was being measured at those points by others, not dealing with electricity and magnetism, but looking into light. There were some optical people who already knew what the speed of light was. But Max Faraday did not necessarily make the connection, but he was aware that there had to be a finite speed there involved with this electric and magnetic process. And then it, of course, when Maxwell put down the equations, it just came out from his math. Right? Okay, so what happens then, Elmo, is that if we have a dipole like this, but we don't keep its distance between the two charges intact, and we keep changing that, we are telling to the rest of the universe that something is changing. Something is changing. Don't believe what you see. Something new is going to come. Something new keeps coming, but it comes at the speed of light, and what is coming is the propagating wave. Okay, maybe this is how you should. This is the ripple. This is the ripple in the pond analogy. Okay? Any questions? So this is an antenna also. The most basic antenna radiator is a dipole. It actually is a Hertzian dipole. And doing the math of this takes maybe about 5 or 6 days of lectures of heavy math that ECE 350 starts with. It's a little bit complicated, okay? So I will not do that here, okay? But if you ask, what is the source of all electromagnetic radiation? I'm no longer talking about the electric field that a single sitting charge generates. That field is the Coulomb field, okay? That doesn't change. The source of that is, well, you have to accept it, all right? But then the electromagnetic waves, that rippling waves that propagate through the rest of the universe, is not coming because of those charges sitting there, but it is coming because charges like that are refusing to sit still and they are doing this. When they are doing this, that Coulomb field has to also change. It is that change that is superposed on the Coulomb field that we are capturing here as the electromagnetic wave. Any questions here? Okay, so then, although it is hard to do this, we can make certain associations, and there is an easy problem I can solve today to give you a, not a practical, but at least a logical source of electromagnetic radiation that is relevant to the plane waves that we are talking about that I erased. Now, I'm saying plane waves, and I'm going to comment on this a little bit more, because there are plane waves, or there are cylindrical waves, and there are spherical waves. There are different types of waves. When I throw a pebble into the pond, what spreads out is certainly a cylindrical sort of a wave and not a plane wave. By plane wave, what I really mean is that this solution that I have, my h sub y was a function of t and c, but it was not a function of x and y. So therefore, if I wanted to see a changing h, I had to travel in z direction, look at different locations. If I change my x and y locations, I always ended up with the same h at the same time and at the same z. Okay, if I fix t and z and travel on xy, I'm on the same plane and the same field. That's why these are plane waves. Okay, small antennas like your telephone from far away appears to be a spherical radiator. It generates spherical waves that are spreading in all radial directions away from your antenna. So there are waves, spherical waves, cylindrical waves, plane waves. Now we're talking about plane waves, which is sort of the easiest. So all types of waves are generated by time-varying currents. Basically, blame electromagnetic waves on time-varying currents. And how do you create a time-varying current? You take charges, move them around. So then maybe I should say, I should look at both rho and j. Okay, and in some sense, I should look at both rho and j. Yes, they are the two ingredients that show up in Maxwell's equations. However, rho shows up the divergence of d equals rho equation, whereas j shows up in the curl of h is equal to j plus dd dt equation. And I sort of like already told you a few days ago that really this divergence of d equation, Gauss's law, is less informative in some way than the curl equation. Because if you know the curl equation, you can get the Gauss's equation, but not vice versa. This itself manifests itself in this incredibly important equation that we learned about last week. That is the rho dt plus divergence of j is equal to 0. What is this equation? Continuity equation, okay? So this, if you know j, you can deduce rho, okay? You can integrate this equation, you can get rho. If you are in a cosinusoidal steady state situation, which is something that we do all the time because it is convenient, this equation has a phasor counterpart. Phasors are now coming. Soon we'll be talking about phasors more than ever. We started the whole business in DC, right? So therefore, we didn't have phasors. We are now coming to time-varying situations, and D'Alembert solutions deal with arbitrary shape functions. So we still don't need phasors. But as soon as we have cosinusoidal signals, for various reasons, there are good reasons to go there, we're going to be talking about phasors. And in the phasors domain, this we did talk about phasors a little bit. When we were deriving the polarization, the susceptibility and so forth. It phases little, but not too much. This becomes j omega times rho, and this becomes divergence of j equal to 0. Now you can algebraically get rho by simply taking negative divergence of j and dividing it by j omega. So basically, if you know j, you can get rho. Okay, so point is to have time-varying j. If you have time-varying j, it is going to generate radiation for you. Radiation that will propagate, radiation that will be not only associated with j, not only associated with h, but also with e, and so forth. So I want to talk about now a radiator of this type.
no engineers can build it because it's infinitely large, but conceptually it is a useful start.
Okay, you can think that antennas that engineers build are finite size, you can learn a lot about them by starting with this idealization. So I'm going to consider now a current sheet. Okay, I'm going to say that at z equals zero plane, there is a current sheet. Let us start that current sheet by declaring that there is a J sub S, and it's pointing in, let's say, x direction, as I'm indicating, and it has some time variation, and I'm going to call it f of t. Okay? But initially, let us forget about that f of t depends on time and think of f of t as a constant value, like 5 amperes per meter. That's valid. I ask the question then, what are the accompanying fields generated by this thing? Well, if this is a non-time varying quantity, I should be able to come up with my h's, and there should be zero e's. Do you guys agree with that? Akash, do you agree with that? If I have a current sheet and nothing else, there will be an accompanying h and zero electric field. Constant current doesn't have any charge density, okay? So zero electric field and a constant h. Can you calculate that constant h for me, Akash? You remember how to do it? No? John? Use your right hand to begin with.
Yeah, so.
So you stick your thumb in the direction of this current, and then you go whoop. And then what else do you do? You say that there is a surface current density that is related to h. H is gonna across that surface. H is gonna. Oh, you're seeing it's pointing one direction, and then it's pointing in the other direction. It's going to jump, change. Okay. And if it does change, by what is it going to change? This is your homework. You did this homework wrong. I guess you guys are just copying from last year's solutions, and then you have no idea what you are doing. How many of you are doing that?
It changes by 2.
Hey, there we go. Change by 2. Change what by 2?
It's magnitude.
So I think, yeah, so he is serious in getting the answer. So what is going to happen? Can I say H is related to J? I think you have the answer. Say it.
I don't know the exact.
Okay, so basically what he is saying is that my h, as it goes through j sub s, it is going to change by j sub s. That's what he's saying. Okay? And plus, our right-hand rule. See, you don't need to have formulas all that much. Okay? Our right-hand rule is saying that h is going in minus y direction above the surface, and it is pointing in plus y direction on the other side. And that relationship is totally symmetric as far as I know. I see no reason to believe that the magnitude of this vector would be any different than the magnitude of this vector. Okay? I know that there has to be a total change of J sub S in H as I go from one side to the other side. And I don't see any reason why one of the H sub S's is different from the H sub S except for sign on the other side. H sub Y. We're talking about J sub X and H sub Y. They should both be, so symmetry of the situation, the above region is just same as the below region, they should have the same magnitude. So I have my solution. Here we go. There is an h sub y. That h sub y is j sub s divided by 2, and 2 comes thanks to Brian. But it has different directions, right? It is minus in the regions that are above z equals 0 plane, and it's plus in the other direction. Now, is this making sense? So I'm sort of happy with this result for the moment. And then there is no accompanying E. This is it. And H has only this Y component. But now, if my J sub S is indeed a function of F of T, okay, then what is going to be the corresponding situation? Okay, so since my J sub S has a magnitude, this is a vector J sub S, here is the magnitude J sub S. So allow me to replace this guy with F of T. Okay? Do you think this is the right answer? And at F of T, we can make the ramp function, if you wish. Okay, this F of T is my previous ramp function of T over tau. Do we think this is the right answer? Probably not. Okay? Why? Or certainly it should not be. Okay, so claiming this to be true for z greater than 0 and z less than 0 would violate the wave equation that we solved. Because the wave equation told us solutions don't come just as a function of time. What do they come as? It has to be this delay time. It has to be this delay time. So I am no good, okay? But this is quasi-statically good, okay? What that means is that if you have a very slowly time-varying current on that, okay, if you don't make the claim that the H that is generated is exactly instantaneous value of the current density divided by 2, not only close to the surface, but all the way to infinity, if you are not making such a wild and stupid conclusion, your conclusion is actually not so bad, very close to the current surface. Okay? So, very close to the current surface, the correction of z minus c is a minor correction, right? Because then z divided minus c that you're subtracting from t is a small number. And if f function itself is slowly varying, okay, if some function is slowly varying, its sample here and its sample there are not all that different, then you say, okay, by using one in place of the other, I haven't made a huge mistake. But when z minus c is a huge number, then you should be, if you are neglecting that, you are neglecting the difference between this guy and this guy. But now that is serious, because now things have changed. Okay? So basically, the amazing thing is that you can now erase this t and replace it minus z over c, and you would be good for z greater than 0. And you would be also good if you put t plus divided z minus c if you were below. Why did I do that? Basically, I did it for the following reason. When we looked at Maxwell's equations in the source-free regions, we got the wave equation. In this problem, z greater than 0 is a source-free region. Z less than 0 is another source-free region. Only z equals 0 is a source region, okay? So, according to D'Alembert solutions of the wave equation that came from Maxwell, a solution of either minus or plus subtracting from t, z over c subtracting or adding from t, is the solution. One of them I should be able to use. Maybe I should be able to use both of them, okay? But this is where you start paying attention to the sources. When you select one solution or the other, okay, then you are asking, where is the source? This is why I asked to Elmo. I said, Elmo, in this picture, where is the source? And Elmo rightly pointed this one. He didn't point out this one. If the source was there, this is not how the wave would have been propagating. It would have been propagating in the other direction. So what I'm really doing there is saying that if the source is at z equals 0 plane here, as illustrated, I should have a plus propagating wave in the top, and I should have a minus propagating wave on the bottom. And the two solutions of D'Alembert allow me to choose the right one for each region. I choose the plus propagating solution with the minus sign for z greater than 0 level. And for z less than 0 level, I choose the other one. Okay? So now I am satisfying in both source-free regions Maxwell's wave equation. Okay? I am also satisfying the boundary conditions. And I can't go wrong. That's it. So, and here is, I'm invoking something that is known as the uniqueness. In any electromagnetics problem, there is a unique solution. Okay, every well-defined scenario is going to be associated with a single solution, not two solutions. Okay, so if one way or another, by luck or fortune, you stumble upon a potential solution that checks all the conditions, boundary condition, it satisfies Maxwell's equations, etc., even though you haven't derived it, you just arrived there, you take it with full confidence, because there is nothing else to look for. There is a single solution, and your solution, or somebody suggests to you, and you just check it, and if it checks, then that guy was right. This is the solution. So there it is. So what did we learn then? We learned that an oscillating, a time-varying surface current is going to be generating an H field that is going to be changing in space and time, just like the D'Alembert force generates. But not only that, I will have accompanying electric fields. Now I can, let me now fill in the picture. This field and this field were the H fields. That's how we started. Now, why don't you help me? You're in a dangerous seat. to figure out what the corresponding electric fields are going to be. Okay, so this is an H, and this is in the 0 plus region. Okay, there is an accompanying E. Tell me how I should get that.
Well, right-hand rule, you have the function of propagation is plus Z above the sheet.
Okay, so
he's pointing.
I should go E cross H, yeah. Right? Not H cross E.
Right.
E cross H, and don't use your left hand, right hand. Those are the rules. So I think having it pointing in minus X direction is the right one. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Okay. So I take this, draw this, and I have an E there. And once I'm there, I go E cross H, I see that it's propagating in that direction. I feel good about that. Okay? So I can start writing my my H. Okay, so EE, electric field. Evidently, in Z greater than 0 region, I should have the H sub Y, and take that and multiply it with eta naught, right? And then basically then supply the direction. And what about for the other side? Let's go to the other side.
Be the opposite.
Opposite or the same?
Same.
He says the same. Let's see. Somebody's saying it's like this, and he's right. Was it you, Akash? You go like this, and now it's pointing in the other direction. It's weird, but true. What did we find out? We have solution for electric field that is not jumping across the surface, but H is jumping. Didn't I tell a long time ago the tangential E never jumps? Tangential E never jumps. Here we see. We didn't impose it. It came naturally. Tangential E never jumps. Tangential H always jumps. By what amount? By the current density. Okay, so our electric field evidently is going to point in minus X direction in both regions, and it is going to be F of T minus or plus Z over C times eta naught divided by 2. That's our electric field. Any questions? So now, what do we have? We have a time-varying current sheet, which means that there are things in motion, okay? Those moving charges generate now, in this example, okay, a new effect that we haven't seen. This is the equivalent ELMO of the pebble. Okay, the real equivalent of the pebble, easier to see, is a single dipole. Okay, but you can say that this surface charge current density is perhaps a lot of dipoles. I have put many of these dipoles side by side on the Z equals zero plane, and they are all doing this. If they are all doing this, this is the field that we are getting. Okay? While a single dipole generates this field that sort of spherically goes out, and therefore its math is a little bit complicated, I tricked ourselves into an exceedingly simple geometrical situation, and without doing almost any math, I have a solution for you. Because the math was done yesterday. Okay? The math was getting D'Alembert's solution. Our solution had to be a function whose time argument is being interpreted in this delayed fashion, Z over C plus or minus. Any questions? Yes.
So on Friday, I thought we determined that the direction can be based off of the delay.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had like a T plus Z over C, that means it'd be going in the negative Z direction. So why?
Yes, all those rules, John, boil down to the right hand rule. Okay? So yes, whenever, so you have an E solution, right? What we did, let's review what we did. You have an E solution, and to find the H solution, we solved, Faraday's law. And in doing so, we came up with two different answers that differed in sign, okay? Although they differed in sign, both versions of it were consistent with the right-hand rule, okay? Given that, we say, let's forget about following the pluses and minuses. Let's just stick to our right-hand rule, okay? So that's where I am. But I'm confident that if I take either the E or the H that I have, and I want to find the other counterpart using Faraday's law, I will always get the right result that is consistent with the right-hand rule. Because right-hand rule works in this fashion, you don't do anything else. You always do the easiest, okay? So be confident about the right-hand rule in that sense. They are consistent, okay? I guarantee that they are consistent. Now, you, being a doubting sort of a guy, can check it a few times on your own, okay? And then if you find any mistake, come and show me. I will have to find your mistake then to show you why you are mistaken. Because, you know, by the time you are 56 like me, you know, if you see it works, it works. There's no more question about that. Any questions here? Yeah?
Is So that means that you have an electric field that is different from the current.
Of course, it's, yeah. Oh, yeah, beautiful. Lee always comes up with beautiful, good answers. Yeah, Lee is pointing out that, after all, this was J. Okay? I'm taking, effectively, a delayed version of minus J divided by 2 eta naught is the answer. That's what he's saying. Right? Let's see. Let's write this down. It's worth pointing out. Thank you, Lee. I was wondering what I should tell next, and you just made it for me. So electric field solution in this case is negative eta naught divided by 2 J sub s, that varies with time, but it is not just time, it is time minus or plus z over c. This is what you observe, right? And what really you are focusing on, what you are really focusing on the fact is that the J is pointing in the opposite direction to E. I want to now say, beautiful. But why? You probably intuitively thought that E and J were going to be parallel to one another, rather than anti-parallel. Let us sort of like think about the consequences of E and J being anti-parallel. So I'm going to say that this is similar to the V and I being in opposite directions through a voltage source or a current source. This is a source, my friend. Okay? Suppose that E and J were pointing in the same direction. E is volt per meter, okay? And J is amperes per meter. If you dot multiply them, what do you get? Volt amperes per meter squared. Volt amperes is what? Power. Okay? So you would get J dot E. Alright, so that is the next thing we should talk about. J dot E is a term in Poynting's theorem, and J dot E is absorbed power per unit area, or per unit volume, depending on which time of J you use. If you use volumetric J, then it is amperes per meter squared. J dot E turns out to be watts per meter cubed. Okay, if it's a surface current, you get watts per meter squared. It is absorbed power, but this surface current is not absorbing power. It is, in the language of circuits, what sources do, deliver power. In this case, this is a power source. It is accounting for all the energies that are going in above and below the surface. It is a power source, and that is why they are opposite to one another. Okay? Thank you. That's a really important point. Okay, so let's see to our notes a little bit. How much time do we have? Just a few. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. Okay, so here are these relationships, E cross H. E cross H is the direction in the which propagates, and E cross H is what we call Lee and the others Poynting's vector. S equals E cross H. It will turn out that E cross H is watts per meter squared, and it's the amount of power that you transport by maintaining E and H as a propagating wave. But if J is available in this medium, then J dot E is the power absorbed. And there is one more thing, time derivative of the stored energy in the medium. All these three ingredients come together in a conservation law we call Poynting's theorem, and it may be time to talk about that. Before that, though, let me see what else I might have had here. I have some examples with a triangle function moving around. I did the rectangle function, I did the ramp function. The triangle function is sort of like halfway in between. It's an easy function to deal with. With the ramp function, you have to sort of like figure out in which direction is this ramp leaning, which is a complication, but that is where the flipping part helped us, okay? So in the homework, I think you have a triangle function problem. Work it out. I'm not going to show the detail. There are some ramp detail examples. I'm skipping all that. Here is the problem that we just solved, right? A x-directed surface current density generating propagating field. So now you guys know one antenna. the universe's largest antenna. It's as big as the universe itself. Nobody can build it, but it is the sort of the idealized source of plane waves. If you say, where are plane waves coming from? If there are plane waves, they are either coming from infinite current sheets, which don't exist, or they are coming from all the other sources of radiation, compact regions of time-varying currents, but they are so far away that the spherical surfaces appear locally to me like plane ones. Okay? We are living on the surface of a spherical Earth, but most of the time we are not aware that it is spherical because the radius is large. We are far away from the center. Okay? In Illinois, you look around, it's all planes. Right? It's all planes. So you can imagine that things that are spherical can be well approximated as planes, and this is why mathematical study of plane waves, even though you can't create any single one of them in reality, is so important. Even though you can't generate a plane wave, most of the sphericals that you are working with at any distance away from a source is well modeled by plane waves. Okay, and you know what a plane wave radiator is. All right, so here's that equation. H is minus or plus y of j x t, but this is before the correction. After you do the correction, the one that satisfied also D'Alembert equation, not only the boundary condition, but the D'Alembert. What is the boundary condition? That as you are crossing the surface, you are always, your h is always jumping by js. That's the boundary condition. And this is the right solution, and the corresponding solution for the electric field that I wrote there, and with Lee's insight, there it is. And it is pointing in the opposite direction. And there are some further examples that I will skip. So I want to talk about the next topic, and that is Poynting's theorem. Which one is that? 21?
21.
Too many tabs. Let's kill some. Lecture 20, Poynting theorem. Yes, it's time to... And of course, the homework calls for Poynting theorem. And two things. The very last problem in the homework asks you to deal with a cosinusoidal situation. The fields there are cosinusoidal. There is nothing new there. Any function f of t is gained, so are the cosines. Plus, last lecture, I already talked about f being a sine or a cosine function. Okay? And in that case, there is omega and beta. And beta and omega are related such that omega over beta is always equal to the propagation speed, which is c in free space, but otherwise it is in general mu epsilon. Okay? And in these other regions where instead of mu naught epsilon naught you have general mu, this eta naught becomes eta, and that is mu over epsilon. Okay, so it's not necessarily 120 pi, but that times some factor. So that's how you will attack the last problem. It's really easy, and I will say a little bit more tomorrow, but here's the main calculation. S is E cross H, it's Poynting's vector, and it is interpreted as power per unit area that is being transported. I think the problem is, how much power is passing in this way over a meter square area? Just calculate this, this is it. All right, so what is this relationship? Did I run out of time? Did I run out of time? Really? That doesn't say so.
Really.
But this said exactly I ran out of time. Yes. All right, so we'll start with this. Thank you.